You're listening to the DX Audio Service.
And welcome to side two of this cassette here, the DX Audio Service. I'm Fred Vobey along with Bob Walker. And seeing that we don't really have any muses here from membership of the DX Audio Service, what we thought we'd do is repeat the profile which appeared in the DX News on February 18th, 1985 about WLS. And this is really a nice article that was written by Tony Fitzherbert in Fairfield, Connecticut. So I'm going to turn the microphone over to Bob and let him read a little bit about WLS Radio.
When Sears Roebuck and Company of Chicago decided to branch into the newly developing medium of radio, nobody in Sears management could envision the long-term influence that their idea would impact on the lifestyles and leisure time across Middle America. When the radio division of the Department of Commerce granted the famous retailer the authority to build a new station on 870 kilohertz with 500 watts of power, this was the genesis for the Voice of the Midwest Farmer, and later one of the most listened to rock stations in the entire world. This is the story of that idea, WLS, the Rock of Chicago.
The bright sound of music that you like best is heard all over the great Midwest. Everyone's choice is the musical voice of Chicago. Of Chicago. The station with personality. WLS.
Sears received the randomly selected call of WBBX for the station, whose first makeshift studios were on the ninth floor of Chicago's West Side Sears Tower. The little station's air date was March 21st, 1924. WBBX shared time with WCBD of Zion. The first experimental broadcast was a rebroadcast of WMAQ programming from noon to 1 p.m. on the 21st. On March 31st, 1924, Sears requested more appropriate call letters to identify the station with its store. The first request was WBS for World's Best Store, followed by WGS for World's Greatest Store. But the station was authorized its third choice, WLS, for World's Largest Store, after the granting of interim calls of WJR, followed by Day's WES for World's Economy Store on April 12th. WES traded its call for the sought-after WLS, held by a ship for its radio. April 12th saw the first use of WLS and was the date of the inaugural program, which was live talent broadcast from the station's new studio on the mezzanine of the Hotel Sherman. On April 19, 1924, a nationwide Saturday night tradition, which would last until the 1950s, began with the first live broadcast of the WLS Barn Dance. By the end of 1924, WLS moved to studios on the 11th floor of the 14-story Sears Tower. Perhaps WLS was one of the first stations to feature country music, along with hours of programming for farmers, as the station's slogan, Bringing the World to the Farm. In October 1925, a larger transmitter was built on the Dixie Highway, 3/4 miles south of Credo, Illinois, 32 miles south of Chicago. The Western Electric 104A transmitter allowed a power increase to 5,000 watts, although in 1928, WLS installed a $450,000 50-kilowatt transmitter at the Crete site. In the late 1920s, the station moved to larger quarters back in the Hotel Sherman.
WLS, 89, Chicago.
In 1928, Sears decided to sell its broadcasting interests, and WLS was acquired by the Agricultural Broadcasting Company, a division of the Prairie Farmer Publishing Company. After the $250,000 acquisition, the new owner moved the station to its Prairie Farmer building at 1230 West Washington Boulevard, where it would remain for several decades. Also, in a frequency shuffle, WLS's share time allocation was increased to 5/7 of the time as WCBD moved to another frequency and WENR moved to 870 kHz. Two other developments influenced WLS in 1928. A court order sought by WENR mandated that WLS share time equality with WENR, and WLS also joined the NBC network. WLS abandoned its Crete transmitter and began to share WENR's transmitter towers and T antenna system located at Downers Grove on February 24, 1931. WLS was authorized a power increase to 25,000 watts with a 50,000 watt operation on an experimental basis. The station was authorized 50,000 watts power full time in 1933.
WLS in Chicago.
WLS built a huge auditorium in Chicago's 8th Street Theater. And this massive studio became the focal point for the National Barn Dance, which was building a dedicated nationwide audience which religiously collected around its radios at 10:30 p.m. when the program was aired over NBC. The National Barn Dance, in addition to sponsors' costs, was a profit source, as it was one of radio's first shows to charge admission to the studios. Joe Kelly, the man in the overalls, was the host. The Hoosier Hot Shots provided band music punctuated with comments like, "Are you ready, Hesse?" followed by a slide whistle sound. Some of the regular cast members were Arky, the Arkansas Wood Chopper, Lula Bell and Scotty, the Maple City Four, Gloom Chasers, the Sunbonnet Girls, and other early country talent. Little Georgie Goble made a regular appearance. The barn dance became a rural American Saturday night tradition.
The new National Barn Dance on WLS.
Perhaps the most epic WLS broadcast was heard on May 6, 1937. WLS announcer Herbert A. Morrison and engineer Charles F. Nelson flew to Lakewood, New Jersey to report, as a matter of interest, on a routine landing of the Hindenburg, a lighter-than-aircraft on a regular arrival from Germany. Little did he know that this routine assignment would turn into the biggest scoop for WLS in its entire history. Morrison and Nelson were the only broadcasters in attendance as the Hindenburg hit its mooring mast and exploded. WLS aired live, dramatic, emotion-laden description of this disaster. Over 30 passengers burned to death as the great dirigible exploded in a fireball and, fed by pure hydrogen, was incinerated in minutes. Horrified listeners heard immediately about the tragedy as announcer Morrison shared his account of this accident live into his open microphone.
Getting a glimpse of the mooring mast. It's practically standing still now. They've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. It's starting to rain again. The rain had slacked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from...
It bursts into flames. Get it started. Get it started. It's rising. It's rising terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning and bursting into flames and it's falling on the mooring mast. And all the folks agree that this is terrible. This is the one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's racing. 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the passengers screaming around here. I can't talk to people whose friends are out there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honest, it's just laying there a massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can hardly breathe and talk and screaming, lady, I'm sorry.
The Hindenburg explosion ended the use of dirigibles as a plausible means of transatlantic travel. In 1938, WLS moved its transmitter to the far south suburb of Tinley Park. A 586-foot-high guide tower was erected for the use of both WLS and WENR. This tower, an auxiliary tower, and the transmitter building are used today by WLS. Located next to the Rock Island Railroad commuter line, the latter has been helpful in an occasional blizzard. When the snow blew, the only access to the crews attending the transmitter has been the passing Joliet locals, which have stopped at the site to bring food and surprise to marooned engineers.
WLS, number one yesterday.
A history of WLS would not be complete without a look at the early life of its frequency-sharing partner, WENR. WENR was founded by the All-American Radio Corporation, a manufacturer of radios. The call letters stood for E.N. Rollin, President of All-American, which was later absorbed by the Zenith Radio Corporation. The 100-watt station began operating on 1130 kHz on March 19th, 1925. In 1926, the station increased power to 1,000 watts and was sold to Commonwealth Edison, who moved it to 1040 kHz and reduced the power to 500 watts. Samuel Insull, owner of three commuter railroad lines in the Chicago area, bought the station on April 7th, 1928, and his Great Lakes Radio Broadcasting Company consolidated the station with his station, WBCN, and ID'd as WENR-WBCN. In the frequency reallocation at 3 a.m. November 1st, 1928, the station was ordered to share time with WLS and authorized to broadcast 4 hours daily on 25,000 watts. The studios were moved to a new $150,000 facility atop the Civic Opera House on Chicago's Madison Street. The station occupied the top three floors, with the studios on the 42nd floor. NBC acquired the station on March 1, 1931, moving the station to 20 Wacker Drive, and the skyscraper studios were closed. WENR-WBCN affiliated with the NBC Blue Network, and the previously carried Red Network programs were switched to WMAQ in 1931. In 1932, the WBCN call was deleted, as authorized by the FCC. The station, now a 50,000-watt powerhouse, used the motto, The Voice of Service. The station's broadcast schedule in the late 1930s was from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. and from 8:30 p.m. to 1 a.m., with other hours allocated on weekends. WENR moved to the 19th and 20th floors of the Merchandise Mart, sharing space with WMAQ.
WMAQ, the good life.
Another business entity figured heavily into the course of WLS's life. This, of course, was its unique and influential parent company. WLS's owner, the Prairie Farmer Publishing Company, succeeded because of very aggressive marketing by its agents. Its publication, The Prairie Farmer, was must-reading by county agents, agriculturists, University Agricultural Extension Services, and its word was gospel to thousands of farmers throughout the Midwest. WLS broadcast hours of live country music. The music was augmented by stock prices called hog flashes, farm and commodity prices, as well as farm news and agricultural discussion programs. The Prairie Farmer formed the Prairie Farmers Protection League in the 1930s and 1940s. This loose network was to protect farm members, properties, and livestock involved coordination with local sheriffs. Eventually, this effort, which involved both the posting of signs on farmers' fence lines, the cooperation of local sheriff to pay special attention to member farmers, as well as efforts to trace and recover stolen property, was tremendously successful. The Protection League was widely controlled over WLS. WLS was one of 90% of the United States' 883 AM broadcast stations, which was compelled to change frequencies on March 29, 1941, under the terms of the North American Regional Broadcasting Agreement. Under this treaty involving the U.S., Canada, Mexico, Haiti, and other North American territories, all American radio stations operating above 720 kHz had to change frequencies. 14 out of the 17 Chicago stations were affected. To a 1940s broadcaster, the move would be the same as moving New York City's WNBC TV Channel 4 to Channel 8 today. With millions of WLS and WENR listeners, a major readjustment of listeners' habits was to be launched. WLS was one of the very few stations to aggressively condition its listeners to dial to the new frequency on the changing day. Radio Moving Day, as WLS and its parent company, the Prairie Farmer, referred to the move, was the object of its campaign, which was one of two such drives cited in Time magazine as examples of how broadcasters affected the change. The reorientation process began with stickers affixed to all WLS and Prairie Farm correspondents a month in advance of the change. 558,000 push-button tabs were furnished to radio servicemen who were needed by listeners to reset push-buttons on their radios. 15,000 cards announcing the March 29th change were distributed to barn dance audiences as well as studio audiences at the WLS Little Theater and NBC studio visitors. All affected Chicago stations contributed to the printing and distribution of the brochure to the estimated 3,500 Chicagoland radio repairmen to motivate them to share in the estimated $500,000 income to be realized in changing the buttons of Chicago's radios. WLS and WBBM sent letters to 200 Middle America utility companies suggesting that they inform their customers about Radio Moving Day by enclosing stuffers in their March billings. 25 utilities followed this suggestion. Illinois Governor Dwight Green was invited to explain frequency allocation on the radio by WLS. His talk originated in the studios of WCBS Springfield and was carried over several Illinois stations, including, of course, WLS, on the day before the changeover. Press releases were mailed out by WLS to over 2,000 local newspapers in Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Wisconsin, using, as would be expected, WLS as an example of a station affected by the frequency change. The Prairie Farmer publication maximized its ability to inform its readers of the frequency switch with both page fillers and full-page displays, which also appeared in the Chicago Times and the radio fan magazine Radio Guide. After the move, follow-up advertising was placed in the media. A crucial part of the publicity was carried in the Prairie Farmer. County agricultural agents were the recipients of letters from Arthur C. Page, WLS Farm Program Director. The Prairie Farmer organization made sure that all its sales force advised farmers and country farm bureaus of the frequency change, so that WLS's most dedicated listeners would be prepared to hear their favorite programs after Radio Moving Day. WLS broadcast several programs to discuss the change. Two guests on successive Dinner Bell shows discussed the reason for the change. And on March 27, 1941, a WLS microphone was set up on the dining room table of Ben McCannon, a Kane County farmer, so that the McCannons, well rehearsed for the occasion, by the way, could ask typical listener questions and have them answered in a live interview by WLS staffers. As WLS left no stone unturned, so to speak, Radio Moving Day was accomplished with no problems. And on the morning of March 29th, listeners tuned to 890 kHz and heard their favorite farm station. On March 10th, 1954, the FCC approved the consolidation of WLS and WENR. A new corporation, WLS Incorporated, was formed to run the station. 50% ownership of WLS was retained by Prairie Farmer Publishing, and the other 50% was controlled by American Broadcasting and Paramount Theaters, the last owners of WENR. On April 1st, WLS was consolidated with WENR and given full-time broadcast hours. In September 1956, Mutual Broadcasting Company programs joined the ABC offerings. Religious programs joined the long popular farm and country programming.
The FCC issued a construction permit for a new General Electric 50,000-watt transmitter at the Tinley Park site to replace the model in continuous service since 1938. In 1960, the WLS studios and offices were moved to the fifth floor of the London Guarantee Building at 360 North Michigan Avenue, from where it broadcasts today. This facility was earlier vacated by WAIT Radio.
Music.
At 5 a.m. on Wednesday, May the 2nd, 1960, WLS signed on the air with a dramatic new format. Listeners, some surprised, awoke with a start to a disc jockey by the name of Captain Stubby. The good captain launched the rock and roll format, which transformed the ranks of WLS listeners from farmers in coveralls sitting around the kitchen table to generations of Midwestern teenagers whose ears were glued to the new sound of rock.
WLS, number one yesterday.
Thus, Personality Radio came to Chicago, and what a parade of personalities was assembled over the years. There was Dick Biondi, ex of Buffalo Rocker WKBW. Art Roberts also left KB to go to the Rock of Chicago. Larry Lujak, super jock who worked in his earlier years on Portland's WGAN, is still at AM 89 and has been between the turntables since 1967.
Larry Lujak plays more music. Wowie kazowie, Larry Lujak, super jock.
Another disciple of rock, J.J. Jeffries' career path from Boston's WMEX and Philadelphia's WFIL to the WLS microphones. And other DJs rose through a sequence of dimly lit studios at night to realize their ambition of DJing on a 50,000-watt giant. The rock format propelled WLS from the doldrums brought by the advent of network TV to being an invited guest in almost every Midwestern home where teenagers were present. Ironically, the format change sealed forever the fate of an earlier WLS success, the National Barn Dance, as any smart programming director does not interrupt nonstop Elvis, Everly Brothers, or Fats Domino for 90 minutes of country music on a Saturday night when radios in every lover's lane and pajama party from Michigan to North Dakota are tuned to WLS. The WLS Silver Dollar Survey was gobbled up by Chicagoland's young adults and was watched, often with the sweat pouring off foreheads, by record companies and aspiring artists. WLS, in its role as the Rock of Chicago, has promoted many events, including the coldest day in Chicago history, January 10, 1982, when the temperature plummeted to a numbing 26 below zero. The deep freeze was observed by the awarding of I Survived the Coldest Day in History sweatshirts to WLS listeners. Another annual WLS event is the Run for the Zoo, whose registration fees are donated in total to Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo. Administrative costs are absorbed by the station.
Music Radio WLS Chicago.
While the Barn Dance might have been dead, WLS live concerts were not. In 1976, WLS broadcast its first live rock concert featuring Styx. Live rock concerts sponsored by the station have become a Chicago tradition. While the performances and the makeup of the audience vastly differs from the studio audiences at the Barn Dance, the enthusiasm remains constant. In the early 1970s, WLS went to a 24-hour broadcast day. And on October 20th, 1980, WLS merged with FM station WRCK. WRCK became WLS-FM on December the 3rd. On WLS-AM, the rock doesn't stop except for Paul Harvey and some late-night Sunday night and early Monday morning public service programming. WLS took another step to fine-tune its broadcast on July 27, 1982, when it first aired AM stereo. Today, WLS still blankets the Midwest with its powerful signal from 360 North Michigan Avenue. The fifth floor headquarters of WLS contains four studios, a newsroom, executive offices, the engineering department, and room for the sales staff. Similar space is found downstairs for WLS FM, whose transmitter is atop the nearby John Hancock Building. Unlike many great rock stations of the 50s and 60s, which have faded into radio history, or who in some cases broadcast big band, religion, or talk, WLS still entertains with the format which made the station a Chicago institution. Its programs are enjoyed by millions of listeners, a tribute to good management and skillful programming and promotion.
Music Radio WLS. WLS yesterday. WLS, all hit music.
WLS in Chicago.
WLS FM
in Chicago.
94.7.
WLS, we get weather.
National Radio Club was very pleased to present this WLS station profile with congratulations to the staff and management of this famous Chicago radio station for 60 years of innovation, creative broadcasting to Middle America. Deep appreciations extended to both WLS AM Chief Engineer and National Radio Club member Al Resnick and WLS FM Chief Engineer Harry Priester for their time which they unselfishly gave and information which they resurrected from the WLS archives for this profile. The editor thanks both these gentlemen and their assistance and consideration which has made this profile possible. Additionally, the National Radio Club is very grateful for all the help that Al has provided to the club over many years. The station profile was written by Tony Fitzherbert of Fairfield, Connecticut. Normally on this side of the cassette, you would be hearing what we call muses, otherwise known as a sounding block for the listeners and the readers of DX News. Since this is our premier issue of the DX audio service, we thought we would present the WLS profile from a couple magazines back for you, since we obviously don't have any real muses here to give to you. In the future, if you have something that you'd like to say, just drop us a tape or a letter, and we'll put it on the DX audio service. If you're recording a cassette tape or a reel-to-reel tape, please make sure it doesn't go any more than 4 minutes. This way, everyone has a chance to say what's on their mind. Here at the DX audio service, we can take either mono or stereo cassettes, and we can take either standard 7.5 two-track tapes or quarter track at 7.5 or 3.75 inches per second. So there's no problem in transcribing pretty much any material that you have to offer. In some occasions, we can even take telephone feeds. This should be arranged by letter prior to actually you calling up and saying that you want to put on a muse over the telephone, let's say. Anytime you're sending anything to the DX audio service, please use our address, which was mentioned on the other side of the cassette. This address is our current mailing address. Address everything to myself, Frederick R. Vobe, and the last name is spelled V-O-B-B-E, and send it to our address here in Westland, Michigan. This way, it saves a little time versus our post office box, which sometimes we don't go down to each and every day. Well, I'd like to thank you for listening to the DX Audio Service, and we will, of course, welcome your comments as to future programs and future things you'd like to hear. Of course, anytime you have any comments, be sure to drop us a line and let us know what's going on. And feel free to use the addresses on the other side to contact the editors of the DX News. Of course, send your subscriptions to the membership committee. My name is Fred Vobe. Thanks a lot for listening, and have yourself a real good day. Bye.